Good morning, dear Sangha. This is the 10th of March in 2011, and we're in the Assembly of Stars Meditation Hall in Lower Hamlet. And the practice of meditation helps us to purify our body and our mind. It's because in our body there are toxins and poisons that make us suffer. And in our mind there are also poisons and toxins that make us suffer. And this suffering has an impact on the people who live around us, who live with us. So we have to learn how to deal with the suffering and so as to cause less suffering around us. And in Buddhism we talk about purification. Purification of our body and of our mind. And in Buddhism, the body and the mind are two sides of the same thing. They're not different identities. And you can't have one without the other. It's like the left and the right. High and low, top and the bottom, or inside and outside. One can't exist without the other. This cannot exist without that. So, in Buddhism, we learn to consider the body as an aspect of our being. And the mind is another aspect of our being. And like a coin, where you have one side and you have the other side, heads and tails. Both belong to the same thing. Because if you have no coin, you don't have heads or tails. So, the body and the mind manifest at the same time together, and one supports the other. Because if you don't have a mind, you don't have a body. You can't have a body, a living body, without a mind. And without a body, you can't have a mind. So to take care of your mind is to also to take care of your body, and vice versa. Anything that happens to your mind also happens to your body. And anything that happens to your body also happens to your mind. So, you have to get rid of this idea, this notion, this dualistic notion that the body and the mind are two distinct things. They can't be separated. It's impossible. When we look at the body, we see also the mind. My body is my mind. And when I look at my mind, I also see my body. So, the brain and the mind are the same thing. You can't say that the brain gave birth to the mind. No, the two manifest at the same time, and one is based on the other. In Buddhism, we talk about contemplation of the body. Good, you can contemplate the mind also, but we always start by contemplating the body. That's important. If you can't understand your body, and you don't know how to manage your body, you won't know how to deal with your mind, how to manage your mind. And the contrary is true also. So knowing your body, it's important to know both your body and your mind. And the understanding begins with mindfulness. If you breathe mindfully, you bring your mind towards your body. That's the first step. That's the first thing to do. To bring your mind to your body, into your body. And your mind is going to recognize your body as the body. And I breathe in and I say, ah, my body's here. That's the Twasiam exercise that the Buddha suggests, offers us in the sutra on mindful breathing. I breathe in, and I'm aware that my body is here. Recognition of the body by the mind. That's the third exercise. Recognition, mindfulness, concerning the body as a formation. The body is a formation. It's a thing. It's a conditioned thing. The word tanghanya, han, formation, is a technical word in Buddhism. Samskara. Everything that is formed, everything that's conditioned. For example, a flower is a conditioned thing. It's something that's formed. And when we look deeply into the flower, we see elements that come together in order to form this flower. For instance, the sun, rain, the earth, and so on. So, the flower is a formation, something that's conditioned. And our body is also a formation. And that's why in Buddhism we say body as a formation. I breathe in and I'm aware of this formation which is my body. And when we see our body, we also see it as something that's conditioned, something that's formed by different elements such as water, like light, earth, and air. And when we look at the body, we observe the body, we see water. We see water, air, we see earth, we see heat, we also see the mind. Because if there's no mind, if there's no consciousness, it's not a real body, it's something that's dead. It's not a formation, it's not a living formation. So the third exercise is I breathe in and I'm aware of the presence of the formation which is called the body. In the sutra that teaches mindful breathing. There are 16 exercises. And here's the third. But before this one, there are two other ones. And the first one. I breathe in, and I know that I'm breathing in, and I breathe out, and I know that I'm breathing out. That's the first exercise. When we breathe in, mindfully, we recognize that the breath that's happening, and we recognize what's happening. And what's happening is a breathing. When I breathe in, I know that I'm breathing in. And I know that when I'm breathing in, I'm breathing in. And I know that that breathing is happening. And the object of our mindfulness is our breathing. So we recognize our in-breath as something, as a formation. In the second exercise, the duration of our in-breath and out-breath. If your breath is long, you know that it's a long one. And if it's a short breath, you know that it's a short exhalation, you know that. And the second exercise is to be aware of our in-breath and our out-breath from the beginning to the end. That means that you're aware of your breath from the beginning of your in-breath to the end, and you follow your in-breath throughout its length. There's no interruption. And that's called to follow your breath, to follow your in-breath and follow your out-breath, to follow the length, 5 seconds, and you keep your mindful intact. You keep your mindfulness intact, and you're aware of your in-breath from the beginning to the end without interruption. So the first exercise is to recognize your in-breath and to recognize your out-breath as an out-breath. And the second exercise is to follow your in-breath from the beginning to the end. To follow your breath from the beginning to the end. And the quality of your mindfulness and of your constant of end of your creations will improve. And they'll become strong. So you recognize your in-breath as an in-breath, and you recognize without interruption the length of your in-breath. And with this mindfulness of your inspiration, of your in-breath and out-breath, and your out-breath, you will also recognize your body as formation. And the fourth exercise that means calm, to relax. I breathe in. I calm this formation called body. So in the sitting position or in walking position, you breathe in such a way that you can calm your body, relax your body. That means relaxation, calm, peace, to pacify, to calm, to relax. So the third exercise is to recognize the formation called body. And the fourth one, you calm that formation called body. It's because in this formation called body, there's something that causes suffering for you, and that something is the tension. It's accumulated pain in your body. There's tension in your body, and there's pain in your body, and there are also toxins in your body that have been accumulated because of the way that you consume without thought. So when we practice the third exercise, you come back to your body and you recognize the presence of your body, and you begin to look deeply into your body, and you see that there's tension, there's pain, there are toxins. And the first thing you can do is to give your body the chance to relax. So relaxation of the body is a basic practice in Buddhism. And when we practice, and every practitioner must learn this, either lying down or sitting or walking, we can always practice relaxation, relaxing our body. That means that we get rid of the tension in our body. Any tension that is left in our life, in our modern life, there's a lot of tension. When we're driving a car, we have tension. When we're talking on the phone, there's also tension. When we eat, there's also tension. So the basic practice in Buddhism is to start by getting rid of the tension in our body. And that's why the fourth exercise deals with this. To be aware of our body, of the tension in our body, and the pain, and the toxins, and to learn how to relax our body. This afternoon, Sister Chong Kong is going to offer us a session of total relaxation of the body. And we hope that at home you'll be able to keep doing this practice every day with members of your family. And each one can learn to guide a session of total relaxation in your family. Instead of looking at TV, we turn the television off and we lie down. Everyone will lie down, and one person in the family can begin to guide a session of total relaxation. Okay, that's civilization. We have to learn how to do that. There are illnesses in our body. That can't be cured without relaxation. Rest is a factor, a necessary factor for healing. When animals in the forest are wounded, caused by another animal, the animal knows what to do in order to heal. There are no doctors in the animal kingdom. There's no pharmacy either. So the animal can find a place, a calm place, and it will begin to let its body rest. The animal doesn't think anymore about going off to find something to eat. And that's because he knows that what's necessary right now is to rest. He knows that. He doesn't think about going for other food, or he doesn't think about going after another animal. No. The animal knows that what's necessary is to rest. And so it will look for a quiet place, and it will rest. And that's wisdom transferred from generation to generation of the animals. But as humans, we also have this wisdom that's been transmitted to us from our ancestors, but unfortunately we've forgotten it. Because we have doctors and pharmacies and things like that. And we've lost our own capacity to rest. Even if we have a lot of holiday time, but we still don't know how to rest. And after the holiday, we're often tense. So we don't know how to rest. So the Dharma teaches us how to relax. If we can relax and we can rest, and we can let our body rest, we allow the healing to happen. Because healing is impossible in a tense body. So the fourth exercise is fundamental. And as a practitioner, we should know how to rest, and how to relax our body. Even when you walk, rest is possible. When you brush your teeth, it's also possible to rest. Even when you're cooking, relaxation and rest are possible. We can do everything in mindfulness, and we appreciate each moment. When you cook, when you brush your teeth, when you take a shower, relaxation is always possible. And when you walk from the parking lot to where you're going, why don't you relax as you're walking? With each step, you can let the tension go with each step. Before phoning someone, why don't you practice three breaths, mindful breaths, in order to relax before calling? And then your communication will be of a better quality too. And that's something we need to learn. Tension, pain, They exist both in our body and also in our mind. Stress. It's not limited to the body alone. It also belongs to the mind. You continue to be affected by pain and fear and anguish and despair. They bring pain and tension. When I talk about tension, I'm talking about tension in the body and the mind. And when I speak of pain, it's both in the body and the mind. In our mind, there's fear and anguish. Anger. And so on. Despair. Greed. These are flames that burn us. We are greedy. We're greedy with regard to food and for glory. Power. Sex. And greediness is a toxin, is a poison that makes us suffer and gives us a lot of tension. And anger also is a flame that burns us, that burns us and destroys us. These are poisons and toxins in both our body and in our mind. And that's why we have to practice in order to eliminate these toxins and these poisons. And what will we use? Water. Air. Mindfulness. Concentration. And wisdom. Compassion. These things will help us to eliminate our toxins and poisons. For example, if you have a lot of hatred, and you want to eliminate this anger, the anger that's in you, because anger is something that really destroys us. You want to punish, you want to kill. You have hatred in you. It's a poison. It's a toxin. And the energy, with regard to terrorists, we want to punish them. We want to break them. We want to destroy them. And that gives energy, that gives them an energy, a very destructive energy. When we're angry, when we hate, we have a lot of poison in us. In order to eliminate these toxins, we need water, we need air, we need compassion. It's the water of compassion that can neutralize our hatred and our anger. And how do we generate this water, loving water, the water of loving kindness? And this is something we can do, we can learn with our practice. We know that in order to purify our body, we have to drink a lot of water. We eat little and we drink a lot. And that helps us to eliminate the toxins in our body. We also know that with breathing, deep breathing, we can eliminate toxins by deep breathing. So deep breathing is something we can learn. In the sitting position, in the lying position, or in walking, we can do deep breathing. We're bringing pure air, oxygen into our body. And that oxygen and that air that purifies, that helps us to take the toxins out of our body. The oxygen is sent to each cell of our body and to help this cell renew itself. So it's very important to practice deep breathing to help the air to come in and to get a better quality of breathing and of air. And we notice that in the springtime, that the springtime is now in manifesting itself. So we have to go out and participate in the springtime. We have to do a walking meditation, and then we can enjoy the symphony of nature that's happening all around us. And we can enjoy each step. And in so doing, we let pure air come into our body in order to purify our body. So when we do walking meditation, we actually practicing the purification of our body and our mind. Not only our body, also of our mind. And when you pay attention to each step and you're walking that way, you stop all of your thinking. And your mental dialogue stops. And this is the opportunity to rest, for you to rest. The mind cannot rest unless you stop this inner monologue that's going on. There's a cassette that keeps playing in your head. And you think of this, you think of this, and you think of that. And you can't stop the thinking. You think about everything. But your thinking doesn't really do you any good. On the contrary, it brings you despair, it brings you anxiety. So this thinking is not what we call right thinking. In fact, it brings a lot of toxins in your body and in your mind. So as you do walking meditation, you stop your thinking and you let the peace and the freshness and the beauty of the nature penetrate you. And you're aware of the fact that you're breathing. And you're also aware of the green around you. You're aware of the singing of the birds. And we let ourselves be nourished by such things around us. And in so doing, we begin to eliminate all these toxic things that are in us. What you're now beginning to touch is pure air, the sunlight, the vegetation, the singing of the birds and things like that, all the marvels of life. And all the things that you want to eliminate, you want to eliminate your thinking, your wrong thinking, your anger, your anxiety, and things like that. And when you walk with your Sangha, with a community, you're transported, you're supported, you're embraced by the energy, the collective energy of the Sangha. Everyone does the same thing. Everyone's trying to stop their thinking. Everyone's bringing their attention to their breathing. And everybody savors each breath in breath and out breath and the nature that's around us. And all together, we can generate a collective, a very strong collective energy. And that's what the Sangha can generate, a collective energy. And that's something you can't find in a supermarket. Or in the parliament, or wherever. You're not going to find this positive energy. Because the Sangha is composed of members who know how to breathe and know how to relax. You're sitting on your cushion. You know how to sit in order to relax. And you also know how to breathe. And in the sitting position, and with this form of breathing, you can generate the energy of compassion, of relaxation, and of mindfulness in order to nourish you. And this energy is combined with energy of generated by your co-members of the Sangha. And all together, we can generate the energy, the collective energy that embraces us, all of us, each person. And when you walk that way, we flow like a river and not like just one drop of water. It's very easy. You let yourself be embraced by the Sangha. And you can do that because you're able to stop your thinking and to stop being a drop of water. And you allow yourself to become a river. It's better to be a river than a drop of water. And when you're in the Sangha, you learn how to become a river. And that means that you allow yourself to be penetrated the collective energy of the Sangha. And this collective energy of the Sangha allows you to stop your thinking, to open your heart, so that your anguish, your fear can be embraced by this great energy. It's a collective energy. It's a collective awareness, and it's a form of nourishment. It's the fourth form of nourishment, which is called consciousness. The first source of nourishment is edible food, the things that we can eat with our mouth. Edible. And the second source is impressions. So sensorial impressions. The first enters your body through your mouth. What you eat and what you drink. So those are the first source of nourishment. And with mindfulness, we know what we eat and we know what we drink. So we avoid poison and toxins. We avoid bringing toxins and poison into our body. And the second source are these sense impressions. When you read a newspaper, and when you listen to the radio, when you have a conversation with someone, we consume also. And what you consume in terms of literature, television, books, magazines, they can be toxic. What we consume with our eyes, with our ears, with our mind can be toxic. So we have to consume mindfully. And that's the practice that's contained in the fifth mindfulness training, consuming with mindfulness. We try to avoid bringing any kind of toxic elements into our body or mind, because a conversation can be full of poison, can be full of hate and violence. And if we continue to listen to a conversation like that, we let those poisons, toxins enter into us, so we have to be very careful. A television program or a radio program, an article in the newspaper can be toxic. When you're driving your car, in town, you're consuming what you see, whatever you see, whatever you hear, you listen to. There are things that you consume. What you see, what you hear, there are things that we consume. In spite of you, whatever you do, if you cross a town, you're going to consume. When ads, you don't want to look at them maybe, but everything's going to attract your attention to the ads, and then when you do that, you're consuming also. Your depression, your suffering is connected to what we consume. We have to be very careful. We have to protect ourselves. We have to also know how to protect our family from this dangerous consumption. The third source of nourishment is volition. What is our intention, our deep desire? When we look deeply into ourselves, we can identify our deep desire, our deepest desire, our deep aspiration. We're here to do something, to realize something. The thing that we most cherish, the thing we want to achieve in our life. What do I want to do with my life? I want to do something. Something that means something, that's meaningful. And that's volition. And it's a sort of nourishment. There are people Some people, like Darius, have only one desire, and that is to destroy, to break something, and to make people suffer. And their idea is, because someone has dared cause me to suffer, I want to punish them. And that's a sort of volition. And terrorism is a very, could be a deep desire too. But anger and hatred are not healthy nutriments. We have to have something healthier. The Buddha, Siddhartha, wanted to practice, and he underwent a lot of difficulties, but he was able to overcome it because he had a strong desire, and he was inspired by, and compassion was his nutriment, his nutrition. And if you want to do things like protecting the planet, you can clean, you can help children to suffer less, or improve the plant life. And these can be a very good source of nutriment. So each person has to look deeply in order to identify his or her source of nutriment. Okay, it's your deepest desire. And so then we pursue. Is it in the pursuit of power or fame or money? And if it is, then that's not a good nutriment. Because there are people who do that, who pursue those things, those objects of desire, and they suffer. And they suffer deeply. So your suffering depends on your desire. And if you have a healthy desire, a healthy aspiration, suffer less. And the fourth source of nutriment is consciousness. Collective consciousness. We live with a group of people, and if that group thinks in terms of hatred and anger, and if the people around us don't know how to have compassionate thoughts, and they only have negative thoughts and hatred and anger and despair. Together, they're going to create a very negative energy. And if you live amongst them, you'll be consuming that energy, full of poison and full of toxins. So we shouldn't live in an area like that, in a neighborhood like that, where people behave that way and talk that way. And where the toxins and the poisons are generated. So our environment is very important. So with mindfulness, and you recognize that you're not in a good environment, and that one that's not good for you, and that's not good for your children, you should try to leave as soon as possible. Otherwise, you'll just keep consuming that collective energy, the consciousness around you. And that's very important. You have to build a community that's healthy, in which each person knows how to have compassionate thoughts and friendly thoughts and live in brotherhood, in which each person has a goal to help the planet or to help children suffer less. And altogether, we can generate this collective energy, this good collective energy, understanding, love, mindfulness. And if you don't live in an environment like that, you have to create it with your practice. You have to speak to your environment. You have to begin to create a place like that for you and for your children. In Buddhism, we speak of Sangha building. Building Sangha, to build a practice community. And in this practice community, we practice mindfulness. Mindfulness, we practice concentration. Understanding. Brotherhood, compassion. And you're encouraged to produce thoughts of comprehension, of understanding and compassion. And together we can create a very healthy place to live. So a person who suffers can come to this place and live in this community. Even if she doesn't practice, even if she just lets herself be penetrated by this energy, she'll be able to heal. And she'll be able to transform herself. That's because there's an immersion. In space. In this space. In this place. In this place where mindfulness is practiced and where concentration is practiced and understanding and compassion. Because in this space, that's called the practice center, everyone tries to live according to the five mindfulness trainings. The five mindfulness trainings are the expression, a concrete expression of the practice of mindfulness and of true love. We try to protect life, to preserve life. We try to live happily, really happily, with brotherhood, in brotherhood, with understanding and love. We try to preserve and not to be destroyed by a destructive behavior with regard to our body and our mind. We try to protect. We try to practice a deep listening and loving speech, and not to produce hatred in our thoughts, anger. We try to produce compassionate thoughts and thoughts of understanding. We try not to say things that discourage others. And in so doing, we try to also to consume in mindfulness, and altogether we can create a very healthy environment where people can come and where they can be immersed, because here everyone practices the precepts, the concentration and understanding. And that's why if we let ourselves be surrounded and penetrated by this collective energy, transformation will occur and healing will occur. And purification. Because in this environment, we don't consume things that are toxic. So the environment can lead to healing and to transformation. Imagine a person who comes in a practice center, and even if this person doesn't know how to practice, but if she comes, allows herself just to be there for herself to be there, because in this place there's no toxins, and this person is surrounded by a very healthy energy. This person can allow herself to be embraced by the energy of the Kalanga, of the Sangha, and that can do a lot of good to the person. And so the transformation can begin from the very beginning day. Because in this environment, we don't consume the way people do outside, and we don't let ourselves be invaded by things that are harmful the way they are outside. So we create. So to create such an environment is a very important thing. After elimination, the first thing the Buddha thought of was to create a Sangha for himself, but also for other people. So, those of us who are the friends of the Buddha's friends want to do the same thing. We want to create a Sangha. We want to create a Sangha where we can take refuge. To be insecure, so we can be in security, and to offer other people the occasion, the possibility to come and to heal and to transform. So the practice of building a Sangha is very important. And we think of this in terms of a nourisher, nutriment. Because if I'm in a healthy environment, I can transform. And that's why I've become a member of the Sangha. And that's why I built a Sangha. Because the Sangha is characterized by mindfulness. And mindfulness, and that's the fifth mindfulness training. When we come together and live according to the mindfulness trainings, we build a Sangha. We build an environment, an atmosphere, a place, a healthy place for ourselves and for other people. And that's a nutriment. And in this environment, we can nourish our volition, a healthy intervention. And we can also together eat less and eat in such a way and to avoid consuming toxins and poisons into our body, both in senses and in our food. The Buddha penetrated dimensions that were dimensions of the reality were penetrated by the Buddha, and those are called ultimate dimension, where there's no more fear and there's no more anxiety and no more despair. And Buddha said that space, that dimension, is available now, here and now. With a little mindfulness and concentration, we can touch this dimension. Nirvana means refreshment. There's no more burning. There's no more fire. It's the extinction of fear, of anger, and of desire. The extinction of stopping. The end of anguish and anxiety. There's an unborn Udana, unborn, an unborn, non-becoming, non-created. Unconditioned. My friends, there's an unborn, non-becoming, uncreated, and unconditioned, and that's Nirvana. It's the other dimension of reality. Because in this dimension, there are things that are nay, in this dimension, there are things that are born, that become, that are created, and conditioned. Those are the formations that we were talking about. A flower is a formation, a physical formation. My body is a physiological formation. My fear is a mental formation. They're all formations. And in the historical dimension, we only see formations. That's all we see. There's birth, there's being, and non-being. There's birth on one side, on one hand, and death on the other hand. Being on one hand, and non-being on the other hand. Creation on one hand and destruction on the other. Conditioning on one hand and the end of conditions. Formation and non-formation. My friends, this Buddha said, there is a non-unborn, non-becoming, uncreated, and unformed. If this unborn, unbecoming, uncreated, and unformed are not, and if they're not there in this world, they're not possible. We can continue. If this non-unborn, unbecoming, uncreated, unformed, is not present in this world, there will be no more to exit for all that is, exit for all that is born, that becomes, that is created, and dies, I suppose. Oh, formed. No, that's formed. Formed. And that's formed. In the dimension of formations and of things, there's birth. Birth. But if there's birth, there's also death, of course. Jata and ajata. There's being and non-being. In Buddhism, the word bhava, the Sanskrit word bhava, can be translated by the word being. But our teachers should use another word that's closer to reality, the word to become, becoming. So becoming is better than being. So instead of non-existence. So instead of born, unborn, it's non-existence. Devenir, to become. Become. Because everything changes, everything moves, everything's changing. That's impermanence. And my body is a formation, is also moving, is changing. And I'm getting closer to my dissolution. And your body too, that moves. So being is not a good word, because being suggests a constant state. But it's better to talk in terms of becoming and changing. So in Buddhism, we translate bhava, it's better to translate it by becoming instead of being. Giving is closer to reality. Being is designate something that's always that way, unchanging. So, in this being, in this dimension, in the historical dimension, there's becoming and not becoming, being and not being. This creation and destruction. There's formation and the end of formation. And dissolution. Formation and dissolution. Science studies formation. Formations. Things that are created and destroyed. Things that are born and things that die. Things that are formed and dissolved. And that's the object of science. And Buddha also studies formations. Physical formations, physiological formations, and mental formations. So we try to look deeply and see their true nature. And we discover then that all formations are impermanent. Impermanent entities without a separate self. Nothing can exist alone. Everything must coexist. Nothing can be alone. Everything has to interbe with everything else. But if we look a little bit more deeply, we'll discover that we'll be in contact with the other aspect, the other dimension of reality called Nirvana, the ultimate dimension where there is no birth and there is no death, there is no creation and or nor destruction, yeah, no formation or end of these formations. And this dimension is available. You have an idea about the being and dissolution, but not about non-being. You have an idea, something called emptiness, existential emptiness. But those are just ideas. When you look deeply, you can get rid of all those ideas. The real emptiness is transformative and healing. The real emptiness is emptiness of all ideas, including those about birth and being and non-being. So the extinction of all ideas, and that's called Nirvana. And we can get in contact with that right here and right now. And the Buddha is talked about that, about the unborn, the unbecoming, the uncreated, and the unformed. Dear friends, if this and this unborn, unbecoming, and uncreated, unformed, there's no exit for those who are born, who are created, who are formed. So we can get rid of these ideas. Even emptiness is emptiness, is empty. In Plum Village, we talk about, we use the image of a wave. that rises and that falls. A wave is a formation, and the wave can be described as that has a beginning. A beginning that rises and then falls, and then an end, a death, so to speak. From, in terms of a wave, from a historical point of view, there's the beginning, the death, the rise and the fall, the being and non-being of a wave. But, and if the wave comes up this high and then begins to thinking about its end, it will begin to suffer. It will suffer because it has this idea of beginning and end, of birth and death. But if this wave practices meditation, it will be able to touch the substance in itself, and it will be able to identify itself as water. And when the wave knows that it's water, it will lose all of its fear. That's because there's the beginning of the wave, and there's the end of the wave, but the water continues. And the water is the other dimension. So the wave is the historical dimension, and the water represents the ultimate dimension. So it's very important for the wave to live its wave, this wave, life as a wave, but also as water. And also, we too have to know how to live our historical dimension. But we also look a little more deeply and live more deeply, and to be able to touch the ultimate dimension, represented by the unborn, the uncreated, the unbecoming, and the unconditioned and unformed. The Buddha said, if that dimension didn't exist, one dimension didn't exist, the other one couldn't exist either. One's not possible without the other. So, with this meditation, we can get rid of all these, the notions of born and unborn, creation and destruction, and formation and dissolution. And then we can arrive at non-fear that allows us to, that allows the wave to be happy about rising and falling. During winter retreat, we studied a text from the Dhammapada in the Chinese version that talked about nirvana. That means the ultimate dimension of reality. And it said that if you come to a practice center and you practice, you can obtain a relaxation in your body and your mind, but the greatest relief comes from only from touching your ultimate dimension. It's not something that comes in the future, it's something that comes right now, and it's possible with looking deeply. please don't take out your earphones because the announcements will be in French. So keep your headphones on, please. I'll translate them into English.